And just to make sure we are talking about the same thing here, I'd just like to show you this picture. So this is going to be about something totally amazing, you know, the universe and its shape and how it's described by general relativity. Maybe you've seen this picture. It's by now a few years old, from the Hubble Space Telescope. Has anybody seen that before? The so-called tadpole galaxy? You can get a high-resolution image from hubblesite.org. So the URL is on here. Hubblesite.org. Totally amazing stuff, think about it. It shows here this galaxy, which from simple redshift analysis, we know is about 420 million light years away. And you can see it really in great detail. It doesn't come out well here on the projection. But when you get the full file, which is several megabytes from the Hubble site, you can see tremendous detail in this. It's a huge galaxy that is actually sort of a train wreck. Another galaxy ran into it, and this is basically tracing out the collision there. Now, the point I want to make is that on that same image, you also see much smaller galaxies. Okay? And roughly speaking, galaxies come in different sizes, just like dogs come. You know, big dogs, big dogs, but no dog is as big as an elephant or as small as a mouse. And similarly, with galaxies, they don't come in such dramatically different sizes. So roughly speaking, those galaxies are roughly the same size as this one. But now, just by perspective, since they are so much smaller, much further away than they be, right? Just geometrically, you can tell that they are at least a dozen times further away than that galaxy over there, which gets us into billions of light years away. So we can see with fairly good resolution, if you look at the original Hubble Space Telescope image, you see that this is more than just colorful specks. Galaxies several billions of light years away. And this is amazing because the age of the universe is only about 13.7 billion years. So we are not going to see any light that has traveled more than 13.7 billion years. Because that's as old as the universe is. So the oldest light that we can see is 13.7 billion years old. This gives us a ball around us of the only things that are visible to us. And with current technology, we are already approaching seeing everything that there is visible at all, in principle. Of course, we can see here lensing effects, maybe not particularly well in this picture here, but it's clear that general relativity is the theory that describes that to a non-specific. So the goal, there are two goals that this course has. One is to develop differential geometry and general relativity to the extent that you can apply it to cosmology. And the biggest challenge there, I think, is to describe the distribution of structure in the universe, distribution of matter, the distribution of energy in the universe. There's this theory of cosmic inflation that many of you may have heard of. Many of you are familiar with inflation? Okay, virtually nearly all of you have heard of it. So the idea there is that the universe underwent an initial period of extremely rapid expansion, which was so rapid that quantum fluctuations would have been, that are normally very small. You see, quantum fluctuations are ubiquitous. They're always there, always around us, and usually only very, very small. But if the universe expanded sufficiently quickly, they would have ripped apart those quantum fluctuations and make them very, very large. And the idea is that those quantum fluctuations, once spread out on cosmological scales,
were the seeds for the initial inhomogeneities in the universe. So at the end, we'll cover some of that. And the second goal of this course is going to be to explain the structure of general relativity to a sufficient extent that you should be prepared to start studies in quantum gravity. Now, you may have had a course on general relativity before, and if it was the first course on general relativity, then probably you did that in coordinates, obviously in coordinate systems, calculating this, calculating that. And the goal of this course is to study general relativity in a more abstract fashion, where we can separate what is real structure from what is a structure that is only there because we chose certain coordinates or other coordinates. Just like in quantum mechanics, you want to know what is really going on physically as opposed to what is simply an artifact of our coordinate choice, for example, position bases or momentum bases and so on. In quantum mechanics, we want to have an abstract formulation of what's going on. Similarly, in general relativity, you want to know whether a particular feature is a feature of the physics that's going on or just a feature of the coordinates. So it's worthwhile and very important to try to understand general relativity in a coordinate independent framework. Just scroll further to have to figure out how that technology works at the end. So about the formalities, the course will be taught Mondays, Thursdays, 4 to 5:20 here in this room, except for probably November 9th, when we may have to move into another room. Office hours will be by arrangement, just let me know. And lecture notes are online already. The ones of 2 years ago are online. Have you all seen where they are? Who has seen them? Some of you, a bit more than half. Okay. So please go to my homepage and then find on the left navigation bar teaching, and then click on that, find this course, and you will find this. This is a printout, or this is a copy of that page for our course. And I will keep it up to date. So whenever there's something going on about essays or, I don't know, anything organizational about the course, it's going to be up there. And I will also send around emails, of course. On this web page, I have posted the lecture notes of 2 years ago. This is how it looks like at the moment. Actually, if you look at it at the moment, you will see already another list of lectures. You see here is enumerated up to 22, and the first three of this year are also already posted in PDF format. Just click on it and you will get exactly what the course is, what the course lecture notes are there. And I try to post them before I teach it. It may be only in the morning before, but it'll be posted before. But that should already be a good approximation. I'd like to change a little bit the curriculum. I would like to put in there a little bit about spectral geometry. Have you heard of spectral geometry? Oh, who has been to my talk last week? Nearly everybody. Okay. Yeah, I thought you might be interested in that. So since we are going to have all the mathematics ready at some point, the Laplace operator on Riemannian manifolds and so on, so I might as well throw in something about that. But roughly speaking, this is a good approximation of this year's lecture notes as well. By the way, I have 2 hard copies of the lecture notes. Notice that the lecture notes are handwritten by this, on this gadget here with a tablet PC. And if I scroll a little bit further down, you will see how that looks like. Now it looks like this, right? And those lecture notes you can always find online for free, but you can also print them, of course. And if there is demand, I could arrange the lecture notes to have printed like this. This is from last time it was taught. It's about as thick as this, and I don't know how much it costs, but if there's demand, let me know, just send me an email or so, and I could have them printed. But it would probably be, it would have to be, essentially the lecture notes of last time I taught it. Because if you want to print out now, right, then I can only print what is available now. So let me know about that. Or, I mean, maybe you don't want to print out, maybe you want to print it yourself. That's your choice. Generally speaking, everything is in there. However, there is some literature that I used differentially, and that is a book by Kalman called General Relativity with Applications to Astrophysics. This book is having an introduction to differential geometry that is very close to what we do here. So if you want more information, the book is more comprehensive than what we do. Also, we are using mostly the notation in this book. There is another textbook by John Stewart, Advanced General Relativity. We will use some of that. And we will use some of Hawking and Ellis' famous text, The Large Scale Structure of Space-Time. Everything that we'll do will be also in those books, except the spectral geometry that will be new. Good references are also those. And then we will cover a particular paper written by Andrei Sakharov in 1969. And I posted it online here for you somewhere over there, and a review of it, because I think that this is a very important paper. Essentially, what Sakharov discovered is that if Einstein had never lived and general relativity hadn't been discovered by him, then the latest in the 1960s, it would have been discovered. Because if you renormalize quantum field theory on a curved space, then this induces the Einstein action. And this is a relatively simple argument, and we'll go through that. Here's the reference for this. It's one of the shortest papers ever, just 1.5 pages. And then there are some other general resources. This course is a course out of a collection of 4 graduate courses that are offered by Guelph Waterloo. There are 2 courses on general relativity and 2 courses on quantum field theory in this bunch of 4 courses. And they have been coordinated in such a way that they complement another rather than compete with another. You can take any one of those, and then any other one of those, and so on. None is a prerequisite or anti-requisite of the other. So as far as the general relativity courses are concerned, there is general relativity for cosmology, our course now. And there is a course called Advanced Techniques in General Relativity. The deal here is the following. This course here is going to focus on the abstract structure of differential geometry and general relativity. It's preparing you for quantum gravity study and is geared towards applications in cosmology. The course Advanced Techniques in General Relativity, usually taught by Eric Poisson, is geared more towards numerical general relativity. Okay. And applications to black holes and similar things. So there should be very little overlap. And then we have 2 courses on quantum field theory. One quantum field theory for cosmology. I will teach it next term. And another quantum field theory for high energy physics, the traditional type of quantum field theory course. The traditional type of quantum field theory course is all about bosons, fermions, symmetries, renormalization, that sort of thing. And the course that I will teach next term, general relativity, no, not this one, quantum field theory for cosmology, is going to focus only on scalar fields. However, it's going to do scalar fields on curved spaces, and therefore particle creation through horizons, through expansion, inflationary cosmology, Unruh effect, Kazimir effect, and that sort of thing, all the vacuum effect. And again, the 2 courses are complementary, so you can choose to take them in any sequence you like. Okay, any questions so far? Do we have McMaster now? No. since we have only Guelph and Waterloo. Okay. Any questions about the formalities so far? No? So now the lecture notes. Yeah. Oh, right. I'm not entirely sure yet. I think there's going to be a heavy weight on the essay at the end. And then there might be a final exam. I'm not entirely sure yet how, if at all, this is going to happen. Whether it's going to be in class or online, something, I'm not sure yet. But in any case, it's not going to be heavily computational. So if there is a final, it's going to be asking conceptual questions. How do these things relate to that? And what's the definition of this? And what can you tell about such and such? Something like this. It's not an undergrad course here. Our plan is the following. We start with a review of aspects of special relativity and the motivation for general relativity. But I exclude myself from that business. I'm not going to go through this because I'm sort of assuming you know that. Nevertheless, I wrote something in my lecture notes about this, and this is basically the rest of the first set of lecture notes. You see that there are 22 sets of lecture notes. And I'm scrolling through the first set of lecture notes right now. The rest of the first set of lecture notes is going to be special relativity, and then the beginning of the second set of lecture notes is motivation for general relativity. I put it there because I wanted to make sure that all of you have a basic understanding of special relativity and know the reasons for doing general relativity. But it would be sort of repetitive, I think, for most of you if I went through those elementary things. But still, I want to make sure you know all those things. In particular, I have a proof in there for example, time dilatation, which I think is the shortest proof you can ever do. Have a look at it. But we have a lot of material to cover in the course, so I'd like to make that assigned reading. Just read through the remainder of the first set of lecture notes, and then also the first half of the second set of lecture notes, because they cover all that material. And then I would suggest that today we start and launch right into business and start with the mathematics of it, start with the differential geometry. So the second point of the course, after reviewing special relativity and motivations for why one wants to do general relativity, which is assigned reading, I'd like to launch right into the differential geometry of Riemannian and pseudo-Riemannian manifolds. And and the next point will be that we apply that to the structure of general relativity, develop the background for quantum gravity, and then finally, we look into solutions of general relativity, exact ones and perturbative ones, and eventually applications in cosmology and the theory of cosmic inflation. At least the classical part of it, of inflation. And then the quantum fluctuation part will be covered in the next course, next term. All right, any questions so far? Because this is really the end of the logistics part. Then I would launch into the technical thing. I will,
yes, there are problems in the lecture notes, but
you're not asked to hand them in. So you can just put them on your own, and if you find problems, if you find it difficult to solve them, just ask me anytime. Yeah, but there won't be any marked homework. And there won't be a midterm. No, I won't. It's not an undergrad course, really not. Okay, so you see what the lecture notes are now doing. It goes into special relativity and motivation for general relativity, which is a part that I'd like to skip and move directly on to second part, the second set of lecture notes. I'm scrolling through motivational things about general relativity here. Okay, and then if you're okay with it, I'd like to start with the mathematics right away. You see, we have quite a bit of differential geometry to cover until we can finally do general relativity. So I thought the earlier we start with the math, the quicker we finish with it. Now, this is not going to be a comprehensive course on differential geometry, which would take much more time. Instead, I'll just focus on the aspects that are of interest for general relativity. I won't be spending much time on proving things. Instead, what I will focus, you will hear me make comments sometime on what of this is on shaky grounds and what is not. Of course, mathematically, it's all pretty safe. You set up your axioms and then work out the implications. But what about the physics perspective? You see, in mathematics, you have a different notion of proof, of truth, than you have in physics, right? In physics, true is what you can confirm in experiment. At least preliminarily, it's true, as far as the precision of the experiment goes. And that's, of course, a very different notion of truth than what you have in mathematics. And in mathematical physics, you have to balance the two. We'd like to be axiomatic about things, but then we may have to oversimplify the situation. And on the other hand, we want to be realistic and explain and describe things exactly how we see them in experiment. But then experimental situations are pretty messy, and we may have to do some idealization. So we're sort of in between the chairs. And ideally, we'd be on both chairs. Right? We want to be right mathematically, but also physically. And there's a lot to be said whenever we make a definition. Is it a sensible definition mathematically? And is it a sensible definition physically? Mathematically, a definition is good if it can be used as part of a nice theorem. But physically, a definition is good, and I'm quoting Einstein here. Einstein said a definition in physics is good if it is useful for overviewing patterns of experiences. And there is, again, not necessarily a match between the two. Sometimes you can make a nice definition for which you can prove beautiful things, but then nature may not be like that. Okay, so I'll try to strike this balance. So it's not going to be pure math in any way, but it's also not going to be the usual physics thing, you will see. And please stop me if you want to have more or less of the one or the other. Okay, so sort of reminding differential geometry. First of all, we will need differential manifolds. The idea goes back to Riemann, 1850s, Poincaré a little later, or Whitley in this century. They've really developed that theory, and of course many others. I just quoted a few. We start with the first definition, and I just throw it out there and explain the pieces then, because I know that some of you will be from a physics background, some from a math background, some even from an engineering background, I know. So just to make sure that everything is clear, I will explain perhaps a little bit more than I may have to explain to some of you. So an n-dimensional topological manifold, which we may call M, is a Hausdorff space which is locally homeomorphic to Rn. The whole idea is to say that a manifold is looking locally like Rn. And this is how you make it precise. But what are the pieces in this? In this definition, that an n-dimensional topological manifold is a Hausdorff space which is locally homeomorphic to Rn, we have several terms that need explaining. Hausdorff, homeomorphic, and local. So a manifold is called Hausdorff, or a topological manifold is called Hausdorff, if it is separable. Which is to say that if x and y are two points and they are different, then they are elements of some disjoint open set. So far, I mean, the intuition may be clear. It means that two points can be separated. So there is going to be an open set around one point and an open set around another point that that don't overlap. Now, there's some physics intuition perhaps to this. If you have intuition that space-time is really some smooth continuous manifolds, then certainly this is one thing that you want. Of course, the question is physics really like that? And that's not obvious because the nature of space-time at the Planck scale is not obvious. But I should have put the two definitions the other way around. I realize, I'm sorry. We should have started with this definition here. So a topological space N is what? By definition, it's a set together with the specification of its open subsets. And those open subsets you may call UI. And they must obey that any intersection of two such subsets or any finite number of them is open, and also arbitrary unions are open. Consider what that notion means. Topological space M, in principle, it could consist of anything, right? You don't have to think of it as points on a manifold. You can think of M being a set that consists of, the elements of this set might be solutions to an equation. The elements of a set might be operators on a Hilbert space. The elements of this set might be vectors in some Hilbert space. The elements of this set could be anything. But this set will be called a topological space if in this set you can specify subsets which you call open subsets, which is legal. It's legal to call them open subsets if they have this property. So if you take intersections of them, it's still an open, what you obtain is an open set. It's one of those sets that you have singled out as being open. And also the union gives you an open set. Why would we worry about that sort of thing? But the point is this, that we want to express the notion of a continuous manifold, of continuity. But if you remember continuity from calculus or analysis, in order to even define what is continuous, you need to work with, let's say, for all epsilon, there is a delta, that sort of thing. Really what you worked with when you did that was with open sets. In order to have a notion of continuity, you need the notion of open sets. You need the notion of a topology on your set. And that's what we're doing here. I hope it will become clear in a moment. You see, I could just throw out those definitions without motivation, but I'd like to motivate why we do that. And ultimately, we know that general relativity as it stands, even though it is so successful, is not the final theory, because we can't quantize it yet. So something in the things that I'm saying here would be wrong. And maybe one of you guys figure it out. I mean, not wrong in a mathematical sense, but wrong from a physics perspective. It's not describing reality properly. Okay, so M is called, you see, when I write def, it means definition, right? And remember, definition just means we're giving names to something. There's nothing deep about it. Definition is just giving a name to something. And here, here's the following definition. We say that M is locally homeomorphic to Rn. If each point P in M has a neighborhood, which we may call U of P, and an invertible continuous map, which goes from that neighborhood of P into Rn. And you see, to even write this down, so that it makes sense, we need to know what continuity means. Right? What does it mean that we have a continuous map from our set M into Rn? Remember that in principle, this set M could be anything. Okay? It could be a set of operators, vectors, or solutions to equations, or whatnot. It could be anything. And the notion of continuity from this arbitrary set into Rn requires that you know what are open sets. We know what are open sets in Rn. We've defined that, of course, in first or second year courses. But what are open sets in M? And we said how we do that. We specify a set of subsets which have the property that any intersection of them is one of the open sets, and also the union gives you always an open set. You see, and then continuity is simply the property that if U is the image of a map, then it's pre-image. Sorry, if U is an open set and it's the image of our map, then the pre-image should also be an open set. If that is guaranteed, I don't know whether you've heard of that definition of continuity, but it's one way of defining continuity, which is equivalent in the usual calculus case, where everything happens on R or Rn. It's equivalent to the epsilon delta definition. If the pre-image of any open set is an open set, then your map is a continuous map. So that makes this business here well defined. So we say that M is locally homeomorphic to Rn. If each point P has a neighborhood U of P and an invertible continuous map from U of P into Rn. So all what this is expressing is the idea that points can be labeled in a continuous fashion. So a local homeomorphism language, what is a coordinate system? See, a local homeomorphism H, which is mapping some domain of M into Rn, is called a chart of M, or also coordinate system of M, or at least the coordinate system of this part of the manifold, just U. And what is it explicitly? What we have here is a map that maps our points of the manifold into elements of Rn. But elements of Rn are basically n tuples of numbers. So for any point Q in this domain, in this patch of the manifold. Just think of U as being some patch of the manifold. Has the property that its image under this local homeomorphism is an element of Rn, so it's just an n tuple. And so what we have is a continuous map from the points of the manifold, at least those in this patch U, onto n tuples. In a continuous fashion. And those n tuples will be called the coordinates. Pictorially, it's simply this. We have here the manifold. Think of it as something like a flying carpet or so. And here's a patch in it. And H is this local homeomorphism. It is mapping points in this patch of the manifold into Rn. So every point on the manifold now has a name, and that name is this n tuple of points. This is the local coordinate system for this patch of our manifold. Now, it can happen that for a manifold, sometimes you have a manifold where you can have a local homeomorphism, that's actually a global homeomorphism that maps all points of the manifold into tuples Rn. But generally, you have to allow for the need to use several patches. And if you choose sufficiently many of such patches, then you can cover your manifold. So a collection of charts, a collection of local coordinate systems, we may call H alpha, whose domain we may call U alpha, so that's the patch that they map onto Rn, is called an atlas if together all those patches cover the entire manifold. It's just a precise way of saying that one coordinate system may not be enough, but if you take sufficiently many, you can cover the entire manifold. But of course, there's going to be cases where we have overlaps of chart. So here we have a chart, we have a local coordinate system, but then we could have a patch. Let's say in the simplest case, you would have another patch over here, which has a map into Rn, another coordinate system over here. But we could also have the situation where there's another patch that overlaps partially with the first patch. And now each point in the overlap has two names, because there's one homomorphism that maps it into one N tuple, but there's another homomorphism that maps it into another N tuple. Each point in the overlap of the two domains has two names. In other words, we have a change of coordinate system. So here's the situation. Consider one patch, one coordinate system. Another patch has another coordinate system, and the two coordinate systems, the two charts, we call H1 and H2. In the intersection of the two patches, U1 and U2, in this intersection, every point has two names. It can be written as one N tuple according to the first coordinate system and as another N tuple according to the other coordinate system. Then since we require this to be continuous and that map to be continuous, we can actually concatenate the two maps. We can take a point in Rn, which denotes, it's an N tuple, right? And it's the name for some point over here. Let's say some point in the overlap. And we can look at the inverse map. So from the name, from the N tuple, we get to the point. And then with the other coordinate map, we get to another N tuple. So we can relate one set of coordinates to the other set of coordinates for the same point in the intersection. And that map that gets us from here all the way to there for points in the intersection, we may call H12. H12 is H1 inverse concatenated with H2. So we first carry out H1, and then we carry out H2. So this would be an equality sign over here. And since that is continuous and this is continuous, the whole thing is continuous. It's a change of coordinates map. Now, what is very important about this is that H12 is a map from Rn into Rn. And for Rn, we have more than just a topology. We have more than just the notion of open set. In fact, for Rn, we know how to differentiate, for example. We know what it means that a function from Rn to Rn is differentiable. We have a good definition for this, and theorems and all that. But you see, this is not just some map from Rn into Rn. This is the change of coordinate of a point on an abstract manifold. The crucial point is that for such maps, change of coordinate maps, we know what differentiability means. And that leads us to a very natural definition. We can say that an atlas, remember that's a complete collection of coordinate systems that cover, whose patches cover the entire manifold. So we say that an atlas is CR differentiable if all its coordinate changes are CR differentiable. CR diffeomorphisms, meaning that they are R times continuously differentiable. Okay, so we differentiate R times and still continue. So that means we transfer the notion of differentiability from the well-known domain of maps from of Rn into Rn into a notion that applies to abstract topological manifold. Okay? You simply say that an atlas is some, first of all, we are just still talking about the atlas. So that's the we are not yet talking about the properties of the manifold itself. We're just talking about the atlas, which is the set, a complete set of charts, complete set of coordinate systems, whose domain cover the entire manifold. And we say that this atlas is CR differentiable if all its coordinate changes, H alpha beta, remember it's all the coordinate changes that go from Rn into the manifold and then back into Rn, are times continuously differentiable. And then it's quite natural that we call a manifold differentiable, and especially that we call it class CR differentiable, if it is a topological manifold which possesses an atlas of class CR. Of course, you can always, if it does, you can always make up an atlas which is not class CR. You can always choose some really awkward coordinate system that has all sorts of discontinuities in it, if you like. But if there is a complete set of charts forming an atlas, such that all coordinate system changes, all chart changes are times continuously differentiable, then it is a property of the manifold that it actually does allow that. And so we say that the manifold is then CR differentiable. And if it is infinitely times differentiable, then we will call it a smooth manifold. Now, there's much to be said about the subtlety between just a finite number differentiability and infinite differentiability. Makes a huge difference, actually, mathematically speaking. But physically speaking, there's no way of telling, really. We use this to model space-time. And I don't know how one would ever distinguish how often time a manifold, I mean, a space-time itself would be differentiable. We don't even know that it is continuous to start with. So for simplicity, we will, in the rest of the course, most of the time, work with smooth manifolds. And if not, then I'll mention it when we deviate from that. But generally, we will work with smooth manifolds, and the word differentiable will generally mean C infinity differentiable, except if specified otherwise. Now, there are some related concepts. A map phi from one differentiable manifold to another differentiable manifold is called an immersion. If there are charts H from the first manifold into Rm and K from the second manifold into Rn, and notice that the dimensions don't have to match, so that the concatenation of H inverse phi K, so the map that takes you from an M tuple into the first manifold M, then with our map phi over to the second manifold N, and then down with the chart K into Rn again, is differentiable and takes the special form that those M coordinates here are mapped into N coordinates over there with the rest zero. This is nearly the same as saying, but not quite, as saying that we are embedding that manifold in that manifold. I'll get to that in a moment.
I suppose you can do it. I suppose you can always squash, so to speak, dimensions when you do that.
Okay.
Now,
Now, if phi is also invertible, then it is called a debedding. You see, because then you're not squashing stuff. You're, you can go back. So this manifold can then be viewed as being truthfully represented in there because you can go back. And then it's an embedding of this manifold in that manifold. And I hope you're already getting a flavor of how you do this thing. Remember that the points of a manifold should not be thought of as being anything else than the members of a set that have extra properties. Right? I mean, in our case, we are aiming towards general relativity and therefore describing differential manifolds that really are supposed to describe space-time, and therefore it all matches very nicely with our interest. But in principle, keep in mind that this is just a set with some additional properties, such as you can tell what are open sets in there. You have a definition of, you have made a choice of what subsets are open sets, and they have this property that the union is always an open set, and any finite intersection is an open set. And you see, so these are very abstract things. They don't have a shape or form. They don't exist anywhere in particular. They're totally abstract things. They don't have any other properties than the axioms that we have mentioned so far. And to get any handle on those, we use those charts because they allow us to always boil things down to maps or other things going on with Rn or Rn. So this stuff is going on totally abstractly, and that is providing us with local representation. And so even though that map abstractly would be very hard to write down, in principle, if it weren't for those charts, which allow you to write down this thing totally explicitly, whenever you write down some map between Rm and Rn, phi, you are specifying a capital phi in the from one abstract manifold to the other. See, remember that if you didn't have the charts, how on earth would you write down, you know, what the phi is? You would have to give every element in here a name. Call the first one Bob and the other one Alice or whatnot, and then say, well, okay, Bob is mapped into this element over there that's called green. And then Alice is mapped into the other element over there called blue or whatnot. Okay? You have to make up something to explain what this map is doing. It would be extremely tedious. So the efficient way to do it is to have those charts. And then you can do abstract things on a concrete level. And this is going to be a theme that's running through the course. See, in general relativity, when you've done a first course on general relativity, you probably saw general relativity in coordinates, which means basically you saw always those little phi maps. Okay? But what we'll be aiming at is seeing what's really going on behind the scenes, this capital phi. You see, the capital phi doesn't care about which chart you use. It's going to have its own properties, and there's going to be many more maps of that kind that are abstractly mapping abstract things into another. And then we just use charts to boil things down into working with numbers and vectors in Rn, for example. Yes?
Assuming that we have one coordinate system and one chart for each manifold. Like
no, actually, I was just looking at one patch of it there. I mean, you have to allow that one chart is not covering everything that's happening. So it's modular, these issues, yes. Just want to separate those issues, yeah. Okay, so as we said, phi is an embedding if it is invertible, by definition. And then if M is contained in N in this way, if M is contained in N, and both are differentiable manifolds, and I will often write differentiable just to speed up the writing process a little bit. I will just write it as differable, but I hope to remember to speak it correctly as differentiable. So when M and N are differentiable manifolds, M being contained in N, and the inclusion of phi that maps M into N is an embedding, then M is called a submanifold of N. Pretty intuitive, I think, but It just has to be spelled out at one point. There are slightly varying definitions about submanifold inversions and so on in the literature, but we will not do things in sufficient detail to be worried about that. And by the way, every smooth manifold can be embedded into some Euclidean Rn of sufficiently high dimension. Not that we would want to do that, but I just wanted to point that out. Okay, so that's the end of the first set of lecture notes. But I would still invite you to read the first and the second set of lecture notes, because it has this stuff on special relativity and motivation for general relativity, which is not mathematical at all. You can easily read this. So, so now I'm starting the third set of lecture notes already. And all the three are already online. OK, so here we are going to talk about the tangent space, how to define a tangent space. So remember what we have. We have our manifold, the differentiable manifold. And then H is a chart. It's mapping some patch of the abstract manifold into Rn, which you can view as giving all those points a name. Each point, each abstract point in the manifold has now a name, which is some n tuple. It's a local coordinate system. Problem is, what is the tangent space to a point? Intuitively, of course, we'd like to think of it this way. The manifold is something curved, something like that. There's a point, and then we attach the plane to the manifold. This, of course, is how our intuition might work, but in practice, that would mean that our manifold is two-dimensional and embedded in three dimensions, and that's not how you want. You don't want to be constrained by that intuition. But one thing we take away from that intuition is that whatever the correct definition is, it should give us a two-dimensional vector space when we ask for the tangent space to a two-dimensional manifold. So, and generally, when we have an n-dimensional manifold, the tangent space is better be n-dimensional. Now, actually, there are three equivalent definitions of what the tangent space to a point of a differentiable manifold is. They are equivalent, but they are all useful, and so it is worth going through all three of them. First, there's the algebraic definition of the tangent space. It's first on my list because I think it's the most powerful one, not because it was historically the first. I think it was historically the last, of course. This definition is a little bit tedious at first, but you will see the power of it, I hope, very soon. And the idea there is the following. We go through the three definitions first, just roughly, to give you the motivation and idea behind them, and then we go through them in detail. So the algebraic definition of the tangent space to a differentiable manifold at a point P, the following. A tangent vector should be in one-to-one correspondence to a directional derivative. Remember that you can differentiate in a certain direction, right? In Rn, of course, you can do this. But here we're dealing with manifolds. We should also be able to differentiate in any direction in the manifold. So a tangent vector should be in one-to-one correspondence to directional derivative. For any direction in which we can differentiate, there should be a tangent vector in this direction. But the point is that derivatives, including directional derivatives, can be recognized by their key property of obeying the Leibniz rule, the product rule, in other words. If f is a function and g is a function and prime denotes the derivative, then the Leibniz rule says that the derivative of fg is f prime g plus fg prime, just the product rule for differentiation. This is a very fundamental thing, and you can, in principle, build the theory of differentiation on just the Leibniz rule. And so the big idea here is that we should be able to identify directional derivatives by their property of obeying a Leibniz-type rule. But once we know the directional derivatives, they should be in one-to-one correspondence to the tangent vector. So we should get the tangent space in this way. This is powerful stuff because no limits involved in this. Okay, so you need not go back to Newton or Leibniz to define derivatives in this way. And in fact, that is very appealing because in studies of quantum gravity, the idea has come up that maybe the states of functions on a manifold should be non-commutative. And then, of course, the manifold is not the usual manifold. And it would seem that everything falls apart. But it turns out that you can still make sense of most of the concepts of differential geometry if you try to make sense of them algebraically. Because that sort of equation can hold true whether or not the F and the G are commutative or not. So that's why I say that this has great promise for physics, because it is more flexible. Then there is the physicist's definition of the tangent space at the point P. Here the idea is this. The elements of the tangent vector space should be vectors. And the physicist's definition of a vector is that it is recognizable by how it transforms when you change coordinates. Now, we know how to change coordinates already. You know, you go with one chart map into the manifold and then back to Rn, from Rn into the manifold and back to Rn. So we know about coordinate changes. We should be able to figure out what is a vector by checking the transformation properties and the change of coordinates. And so that's how physicists like to identify the tangent vectors, by their property that they are vectors. See, the algebraic definition recognizes them by their property of corresponding to directional derivatives. Derivatives can be identified through the Leibniz rule. Here we identify the tangent vectors by their property that they are vectors and therefore should have particular transformation properties under change of charge. And then, thirdly, as the geometric definition of the tangent vector space, here the idea is that the elements of the tangent vector space ought to be literally tangent vectors to path. So you have here your manifold, think of it again as some sort of flying carpet, and here you have a point on it. Now consider a path that goes through this point. And then look at the tangent vector to this path. It should be in one-to-one correspondence to an element of the tangent vector space. I mean, think of the path, of course, as being inside the manifold, inside the two-dimensional manifold. So the tangent vector to this path should be corresponding to a tangent vector in the tangent vector space. Now, depending on what you want to do, any one of the three definitions might be the most appropriate. So they are all equivalent, but one needs to know of all three of them.
Let's start with the first one, with the algebraic definition. As I said, the idea is that the tangent vector denotes a directional derivative. Now, tangent should identify a derivative. I should identify a direction, and the directional derivative should identify a direction. So they should be one-to-one correspondence. But directional derivatives are recognizable by Leibniz rule for derivatives. Mm-hmm. So in the case of the simple situation where the manifold is simply Rn, we know that this works. You can easily check it. So if the manifold is Rn, then any tangent vector, let's call it psi, at the point P can indeed be viewed as a directional first derivative. So this is a partial derivative. If we apply that on a function, then we're differentiating in the ith direction. Remember, our manifold is nothing mysterious here, it's just Rn. So we have n different directions, n partial derivatives. We have chosen the canonical coordinate system on Rn. So d by dxi is the partial derivative, which is to say it is the
derivative in the direction I. Now, let's look at an arbitrary linear combination of derivatives in all of the directions. So we write coefficient psi I times the partial derivative. They are evaluated, to be evaluated, of course, at the point in question, at the point P of the manifold. So psi is, we just define it in this way, we define a directional derivative as being some linear combination of the directional derivatives in the coordinate direction. Of course, choosing those coefficients suitably, you can differentiate in any arbitrary direction you want. And then our algebraic definition of the tangent vector space on Rn would simply amount to saying that this is what we call a tangent vector. You might think it odd that the tangent vector is a derivative here, right? It's a derivative after all. But it's what we set out to do. The tangent vector is in one-to-one correspondence to a directional derivative. When the tangent vector is supposed to denote a direction, the directional derivative is supposed to denote a direction, here we go. They're actually the same here. So the tangent vector is a directional derivative. And of course, it's specified in the chosen coordinate system by those coefficients. That is what determines the direction in which you differentiate. So what does a tangent vector really do? Well, according to the algebraic definition, a tangent vector maps functions on the manifold, and of course they have to be differentiable, but we'll assume this throughout. So a tangent vector maps functions into numbers. The tangent vector at point P can be fed any function you like, and then your tangent vector can be applied to that function to do the following. You take the function, differentiate it, and evaluate the derivatives at psi equal p. Evaluate those partial derivatives at psi equal p. And sum them up with the suitable weight that identifies the direction which you differentiated. That gives you a number. It's the directional derivative of f in the direction determined by the psi r. So the key point here to keep in mind is that psi is feeding on functions and giving you numbers. Okay, so you feed it a function and it gives you a number. It evaluates the derivative of that function in the direction specified by psi at the point p. And indeed, this definition of the tangent vector, of the tangent vector, obeys a Leibniz rule. Remember that this means our tangent vectors are derivatives. Each tangent vector is a derivative. And indeed, they act like derivatives. They obey a product rule. They obey a Leibniz rule. Namely, if you apply a directional derivative, or in other words, a tangent vector, to the product of two functions, which is itself, of course, a function, if you apply the tangent vector, that is to say the directional derivative, a directional derivative onto some function which is the product of two functions, then you're really getting the result of applying the tangent vector on just the first function multiplied with the second plus vice versa. The usual Leibniz rule thing at every point P. Now that sort of equation, we will be able to write down also for the abstract manifold. This thing, we were able to write down only for Rn. Because for Rn, we already know what certain directional derivatives are. We know that the directional derivative in the direction I is simply d by dxi. So we were able to write down every directional derivative simply in this way. But on a generic differentiable manifold, we have no such luxury. We don't have d by dxi. There are no coordinate systems built into it, into an abstract differentiable manifold. So we will try to identify what the tangent vectors are by this property, namely that they should still obey this. Easy to check just from the fact that they are just linear combinations of ordinary derivatives, that a tangent vector obeys this equation here, Leibniz rule for Rn, and we will simply require that it should also hold for manifolds in general. Yep.
Think of the relationship between the Leibniz rule and directional derivatives. Why are they
good? Okay. I think you should, for the moment, simply forget about the direction. You see, do you see the connection between Leibniz rule and derivatives?
Oh, I see.
All right. Okay. Put it this way. Let's say, okay, functions, if you take the constant function, I'm just thinking of ordinary first year calculus. I'm trying to make the simplest possible example. Think about the constant function plus the linear function, so f of x is x, right? And then quadratic, x squared, x to the third, and so on. If you look at linear combinations of those functions, you get all sorts of polynomials. And then if you do a little bit of analysis, you can do it in power series, and that gives you really a rather large function space of them. Okay? Now imagine somebody says, I'd really like to be able to differentiate, but I just can't wrap my mind around Newton or Leibniz's description of how differentiation ought to work. Then somebody can come and help you with this and say, look, the derivative of the constant function is zero. And this holds. And then you can work out the rest. Okay? With a little bit of analysis, you see that cosine and sine are also power series with the infinite radius of convergence. And again, this thing is wrong. Now you can differentiate everything away. Okay, so all you need is a little starting point and this and you're done. So similarly,
that's basically how powerful the Leibniz rule already is. Okay, now before we can do this for general manifolds, we need a little bit of a preparation as well. Assume that M and N are differentiable manifolds. And consider an arbitrary function phi that runs from one manifold into the other. For simplicity, let's just say it's just some arbitrary function, of course, differentiable function that maps from M into N. And remember what differentiable then means. It means that you can have a chart from this into Rn, from that into Rn, and then if you go this way, you get differentiable function. It's from Rn into Rn. So assume you have some arbitrary differentiable function, let's say, from one manifold M into another manifold M. Now choose a point P on the manifold. Then we define what we call the germ of the function phi at P, which we will call phi P bar. We will need this concept only temporarily, but we need it. And the germ of a function phi at P is simply the equivalence class of all those functions psi, which happen to be the same as phi in some neighborhood of P. So every function phi induces some germ. So if you have one function phi, then how do you decide whether another function is in the germ of phi, is equivalent to phi, is in the same equivalence class? How do you decide that? Well, all you have to do is to check whether there is a neighborhood of P on which phi and pi are the same. That means they're locally the same. That's why it's called the germ of a function. see two functions are in the same germ if they if there's a neighborhood of P on which they are the same. They might be totally different further out, but what do we care with the difference here? Right? So there we only need to know what does the function look like at P and around P. So the germ is the germ of phi is the equivalent subset of all those functions that agree with phi totally, at least in some neighborhood of P, which might be arbitrarily small, but in some neighborhood. So intuitively speaking, when we're dealing with differentiable functions, we certainly expect that those functions agree in their derivatives and even higher derivatives. I mean, you could even do that mapping into R, for example. You know, it's a definition that runs for that works for any arbitrary set of two manifolds, and one of them might be R, for example. Keep in mind that about this definition that. To specify a germ, it suffices to specify any one of its functions, right? Because it will generate an equivalence class of all those functions that agree with that given function, at least in some neighborhood. And we will call the set of all those germs, of all those equivalence classes, F of P. So an element of F of P can be specified by giving some function. And this function will stand for an entire equivalence class of functions, all those functions that agree with our function in some neighborhood of P. But some functions don't agree, simply don't agree on any small neighborhood of P, and they will be different. They stand for different elements of F of P. So we're simply bunching together functions that should be considered equivalent for the purpose of the local analysis of what's going on around P. Well, it's easy to show that when you take a function f and then look at its equivalence class of all those functions that agree with it on a neighborhood, which you denote by putting a bar on it, then they obey this little property. So remember, f is a function. F bar is the germ of it, which is this, to say the set of all those functions that agree with f on some little neighborhood of p. And then you can show that if you first take the function multiply with c and then put the bar on it, look at the equivalence class, you get the same thing as if you first put the bar on it and then multiply with c. And similarly, those little things also hold. Nothing deep there. The point is that those axioms mean, these properties mean, that f of p obeys the axioms of an associative algebra. See, what is an associative algebra? With an associative algebra, you have to have that an associative algebra is a set, which is also a vector space, with respect to some operation that you may call class. It's some vector space, but it's also a ring, actually. You also need some multiplication, and you need that the whole thing happens over, in our case, the real number. Doesn't have, could be some field, but generally over the, in our case, over the real number. Now you see, the point again is that what we've boiled things down to is algebraic properties. And you may notice here that so far we have arrived at the notion of associative algebra. Things that we can, roughly speaking, an associative algebra is a set consisting of elements such that if we add them, the addition is commutative, and if we multiply them, then there doesn't have to be an inverse. So we have a notion of addition and a multiplication. We arrived at this notion here, but so far we never needed anywhere that this algebra is actually commutative. If these are functions on a manifold, in the usual sense, of course you have commutativity. But because we defined everything algebraically, we will eventually be allowed to consider even non-commutative algebra and then make sense of differentiating and tangent spaces and whatnot, even in a non-commutative setting. So finally, we are ready now for an algebraic definition of the tangent space. We are out of time after that. Remember the idea? The elements of the tangent space are to be identified with first derivative. A tangent vector is to be pointing out a direction, and therefore it is to be in one-to-one correspondence to a directional derivative. But derivatives are recognizable by obeying the Leibniz rule. So here's the definition then. The tangent space, Tp of m, of a manifold at the point P, is the set of what we call derivations of the algebra F of P, which is to say, it is the set of linear maps that take linear maps psi, which map elements of the algebra F of P. Remember what the algebra of F of P contains? It contains those germs. It's mapping those germs, or if you like to think about it this way, functions, because every function identifies a germ. It maps those functions or their germs into real numbers in such a way that the Leibniz rule is obeyed. Okay? You see, this is very general here. A tangent vector, according to this definition, anything qualifies as a tangent vector if it is a linear map that you can feed any function, you get out a number, in such a way that the Leibniz rule is obeyed. If you remember, we first did the definition for Rn. And we said that, let's just scroll up for a moment. Here we go. Here, this was the case for when the manifold is actually Rn. In this case, we said that the tangent vector is this object here. And what does it do? You can apply a function to it. You see, this is a differential operator waiting to eat a function. It wants to differentiate something at the point. And when we give it a function, it will do that. It will differentiate it at the given point, yielding a number. This is a linear combination. The outcome is a number. Okay? So you feed it a function, or it doesn't matter which function out of an equivalence class, of a germ equivalent function. So you feed it a function or a germ, and you get out a number, OK? And you get out a number in such a way that the Leibniz rule is obeyed. And all we did now in a more general setting is the algebraic definition is that a tangent vector is a linear map that maps functions, or the entire germ, doesn't matter, into real numbers such that the Leibniz rule is obeyed. If you take your tangent vector and apply it to the product of two functions or their germs, then you get a number which is the same number as if you apply the tangent vector just on the first function times the second function evaluated at a point plus the other result. That's the Leibniz rule there. Is there a question?
So in fact, these germs have functions. The set of all germs of functions is, in fact, the set of all germs of real functions.
Yes, that's right. Everything real in this context. Yeah, sorry, I should have said that. Yes, these things can be generalized, but we're not doing it here. Right, so maybe just let me end with a few remarks. So this definition is abstract enough, not only to work for arbitrary differential manifolds. This definition is also suitable for non-commutative geometry, as I already pointed out, where the algebra of functions or the algebra of germs of functions at the point may be non-commutative. And the reason is that we are here dealing simply with the derivation of an algebra. So we have an algebra which is you know, an algebra could be any set that is basically a ring over a field. And commutativity is not required in this. And the derivation is simply any linear map that takes elements of this algebra into real numbers such that Leibniz rule is okay. Yeah, you notice that we never had to take any limits in this. It's not a Newton-Leibniz type of derivatives definition. Right. Are there any questions?
All right, then let me just reiterate that
here in class we had a sheet going around. Has it been collected? Now, if you came in after it was collected, please send me an email just so that I have your email address and I can put you on the mailing list for the class in case there's some news to spread. And in your email also indicate, please, whether you take the course for credit or you take it just for audit. Right. Also, have a look at the lecture notes. We already are halfway through the third set of lecture notes. On my homepage, I hope you find everybody finds the homepage. Also, if you would like a printed set of lecture notes of last time I taught it, then let me know, and I'll find out how much it would cost if I had it printed at university. But of course, you can just print it yourself or just bring it online as well. I have two copies left over from last time. I don't know if we should do a lottery as well. Well, whoever comes first gets them, I suppose, something like that. Okay. Well, so I'll see you hopefully on Thursday at 4. Thanks.